You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, this is the Orthodox Nationalist. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson. Today's date is the 9th of November, 2024. I have a book I'm working on about Peter the Great's war on the church. Well, not just Peter, but also his successors. And what we're going to deal with today is the end of that, the early 19th century. The reign of Alexander I. There's always been a great ambiguity about him from an Orthodox point of view. But I want to talk about something very specific, but also, given the time period, very general. And that is both the Holy Alliance and the ecumenical mentality that came out of it manifests in something called the Bible Society. You hear something like that in an Orthodox country, you should be very suspicious. They already had Bibles and scriptures and the fathers and everything else. One of the warriors against this Bible society was St. Innocent, Bishop of Penza. And on the opposite side, you had a very debased oligarch named Alexander Golitsyn. After the French Revolution guttered out both in the Terror, and of course, like all revolutions, civil war derives directly from it, ending with Napoleon, the left had to do some rethinking. Russia was in a very advantageous position because it had driven not just Napoleon out of Russia, but all the way back to Paris. It was an extremely unprecedented. I mean, there was nothing where Russia was ever in such a position before. Now, as far as Russia goes, you know, the 18th century, the Petrine century, it did see a hollowing out of the Orthodox Church and the earliest manifestations of Freemasonry, starting in the middle of that century, you know, almost as if the regime started to appear in outline at the time. But after Peter's death, the revolutionary aims that he promoted were continued, Lord Byron being the most obnoxious, but then later Golitsyn himself. The fact of the matter is that Freemasons and other non-Christians were able to take over the secularized Petrine Synod, and it just shows you how low the leadership of Orthodoxy had fallen in Russia at the time. One of the vehicles of this takeover was Golitsyn's Bible Society, an explicitly ecumenical and Masonic body that had, at least for a time, the explicit support of Alexander I. The Holy Alliance came out of the victory of Russia, a very popular victory. In other words, it wasn't the regular forces necessarily, and of course had three members, as most of you know, Austria, Hungary, Prussia, and Alexander's Russia. Allegedly, the Holy Alliance was supposed to be to prevent a new revolutionary movement from ever taking power. But it was an inherently secular body. Of course, it was a royalist body, in a way. But because you had three branches of Christianity here, ecumenism became very fashionable. And ecumenism was one of the first assaults on the church, both in the West and in the East, by oligarchs who wanted to continue the work of the Freemason Johann von Byron, who died in 1772. Byron, under one of the Annas, post-Petrine a so-called emperor, that she didn't have any power, but he purged massively the Russian elite and demolished the church. And it was so bad, it came to be known as the Byron of Sheena. Tsar Alexander I allegedly died in 1825. That's the official number. I'm not sure about that, and I did a whole lecture on that years ago. But regardless of the Holy Alliance, the rise of this Masonic ecumenism with a revolutionary purpose would have been impossible without the purges of the church that continued from Peter to the Regent Byron all the way to Catherine the Great. The ideological basis of all of this was the rise of a different form of revolution, this strange version of Christianity connected to the oxymoron of Protestant mysticism. So I want to talk about how this quiet revolution played out, the means by which it sought to deceive the Russian public and the church, and of course the reaction, thank God, a victorious reaction from two men in particular, St. Innocent Smirnov of Penza, eventually became Bishop of Penza, young man, and his biographer, the great archimandrite Phocius Spassky. The ideological atmosphere in Western Europe after Napoleon, there are so many elements here. The rise of the Rothschilds can never be denied. The early outlines of the regime, even the left was rethinking what revolution should be. But religiously, of course, you know, the church, regardless of what country you lived in, had to be your primary target if you were going to revolutionize society. One of these people, Franz von Baader in Germany, said, quote, "True theocracy must take the place of democracy. The pagan element must be eliminated from public life. A new national law must be created on the basis of the gospel teaching." That sounds reasonable. But the devil is in the details, and these details usually take the form of how terms are used, both the exoteric, or the public meaning, and the esoteric, meaning the inward, meaning known to initiates and initiates only. And the terms here would be theocracy, pagan, and gospel. Freemasonry tried to veil its agenda under the term mystic or mystical, but nothing in any of these movements can be remotely considered mystic. So if you understand some of the esoteric meaning of these terms, you're able to deconstruct this movement, a movement which to some extent still exists. Alexander I, at least at this stage, early on, wanted to recreate not just the entire political system of Russia, but all of Europe, in this vague phrase, something called Christian ethics. Of course, the elimination of nationalism, the adoption of cosmopolitanism, and this morality of the gospel to be applied to politics. So rather than Russia using its position to spread the church and to educate, it gave the impression that the world's problems could be solved by a joining of religions. We're not talking about cooperation here. That's perfectly understandable. No, we're talking about the fact that doctrine doesn't mean anything, and it really should be one church. Religious compromise is inherent to the organization where you have those three powers, Prussia, Russia, and Austria. Of course, nationalism was condemned as a source of war. We're talking about ethno and racial, not the civic nonsense. Nationalism didn't cause the war. It was revolutionary France, the very opposite of nationalism. You need to remember that the left, coming from Freemasonry, I don't think Masonry is all that important anymore. It's gone way beyond the 33rd degree at this point. But the ideology and the cellular structure is still there. But they based their entire public agenda on deceit and double talk. And they were fearful of a popular reaction. So Alexander took the Holy Alliance as a way to create this pan-Christian order in Europe. Alexander saw it as a way to recreate the world, not on the basis of Orthodoxy, but this new ecumenical body. Protestants and Masons call this the apocalyptic battle between good and evil, anticipating the coming kingdom of God. Now, of course, in their mind, the evil were people like me, Orthodox traditionalists like your commandrite Vosius. The kingdom of God was a revolutionary and oligarchic system. And out of this came a pseudo-spiritual cosmopolitan idea that even Alexander supported for a time. Now, the key ingredient to this, we have the external entity of the Holy Alliance. But within Russia, Alexander came under the spell of his childhood friend, Alexander Golitsyn, who died in 1844. And his power was such that he was able to determine the spiritual atmosphere of the reign, at least for a while. But that atmosphere also had the murdered corpse of Tsar Paul, who wanted to stop and reverse the revolutionary movement put in power by Peter. That was hanging over it. He was murdered in 1801, canonized, considered a martyr. He was murdered by agents of Catherine the Great to pave the way for her grandson's succession. That is to say, Alexander. This was their way of defending the revolution. Of course, even Peter III was involved. Now, Golitsyn, personally, he descended from a family of Lithuanian origin. He was a direct descendant of Prince Bia Golitsyn, who was the tutor, or one of the tutors, of Peter the Great. Now, Golitsyn's mother was close with Catherine's lady-in-waiting, Perekushina, introduced to the empress and educated at her expense in the page corps. 1783, Golitsyn was granted the rank of page, a European imitation, and he continued to be promoted. He was the closest advisor of his old friend, the future Alexander I, Alexander Pavlovich. Eventually, Golitsyn became the chamberlain of the imperial court, but even without these titles, it really doesn't matter, because he was very close to Alexander, which was disastrous for a time. He was one of the central figures, not just in state and public life until either the death or the abdication of Alexander. Making matters far, far worse, at the insistence of Alexander, in 1803, Golitsyn was appointed the chief prosecutor of the Holy Synod and secretary of state. No one was more powerful than Golitsyn, with the exception of the Tsar himself. Despite the fact that he hated the church, was a Freemason, he still now is a secular head of the Synod. Golitsyn was known not just in Russia, but across Europe as what we would today call a sex addict. They used to call it erotomania at the time. He was a strong follower of Voltaire. He was a hedonist. And as he, you know, as he was declining near the end of his life, he's talking about his youthful debauchery in the close circle of these venal ladies-in-waiting, and how he laughs, and he said they didn't even realize that the chief prosecutor of the Holy Synod was visiting them, visiting in course in quotes. Now, nothing there bode well for the future of Russia or the church. Now, once he was appointed, of all things, chief, you know, the secular head of the church, under the Tsar himself, he claims to have read the New Testament. You know, the implication is that he didn't read it before, which is very possible, and he became a changed man. But what that was is very ambiguous. He began to seek the company of these so-called mystic writers, representatives of various faiths throughout the empire. He even claimed to have experienced mystical raptures, despite his total lack of theological education or experience or any kind of grounding whatsoever. He had zero religious grounding in anything. And like his view of sex partners, he just went from one to another as his passions drove him. The Metropolitan of Moscow, the great St. Philaret, said in his memoirs, which were first published in 1906. When the emperor appointed Prince Golitsyn as the chief prosecutor, Golitsyn said, "How can I be the chief prosecutor? You know I don't have any faith." "When," said Golitsyn after, "I saw that the members of the Synod were doing things seriously, and I became more serious, more respectful of their affairs of faith in the church, when after a year or two I asked myself, do I believe? I saw that I do believe, as I believed in childhood." Now, for the most part, St. Philaret is quoting Golitsyn. And my translation, anyway, is just as confused as Golitsyn personally. And like all of these movements, primarily he was indifferent, and this is the exoteric understanding, he was indifferent to the differences of the various Christian denominations. Somehow he considered them all equal, and trying to embody this by reading and talking to and studying the so-called mystics, and by which he just meant the Protestant individualists and Freemasons. His goal was the unification of all faiths in the bosom of universal Christianity. The purpose is nothing short of the kingdom of God on earth. He did believe in the external loyalty to the Orthodox Church, at least for now. He said, "As long as we live under this shell and wear out this external shell, we must outwardly belong to one of the Christian churches until we have one pastor and we form one flock. Let us respect the appearance, internally perfecting ourselves with the Holy Spirit." Shell, of course, is a Kabbalistic term. I think I translated it properly. It could both mean traditional institutions or our own bodies. Now, Golitsyn was never particularly sophisticated, but he knew how to couch revolutionary ideology in trendy verbiage. He was extremely pompous, and he clearly became a part of the Masonic movement. Now, I don't think any conversion existed, like the textbook seemed to suggest, but again, it proves how low Russia had fallen spiritually. Oh, and by the way, it should surprise no one that Golitsyn was also a homosexual, or at least bisexual. And I cited an author named Cohen, obviously Jewish, from 2001, talking about it at some length. Now, before I continue, I want to give a summary of Freemasonry. To do that, I use Albert Mackey. Now, yes, he wrote his famous book in 1930, but I have no reason to believe that it's changed at all from the time of the Holy Alliance and he's, you know, in his Masonry Defined, he does explain the system in detail. It became almost official, but he also claimed that this goes back to its founding. So there's nothing, you know, it's not like he invented it in 1930. But earlier versions of this book existed long before Mackey came around, and certainly existed in this form or very close to this form in Russia in the 18th and early 19th century. Mackey's good because it's a definitive statement of the more speculative degrees, that is, the degrees beyond the third. And the point of the book is to reveal the hidden meanings of the degrees, etc. This process is a classic part of the Masonic ideology. So, for example, so when I say Mason, I'm not just, you know, giving this conspiratorial group. It's very specific. The 13th degree is the Royal Arch of Solomon. Within it, it features the oath to the destroyer. It turns out to be a hybrid of Moloch and Baal under the blasphemous cover of the name Yahweh. Remember, they're not using words in the same sense that we do. 16th degree begins the demonic initiation. And the first step in that degree is that a Mason has to swear that nature is eternal and uncreated. This degree is called the Prince of Jerusalem, and that's where you have the first few steps in the revolutionary struggle against the church, and really the spirit in general. Now, I mention Mackey also because the 19th degree, that of the Grand Pontiff, Peter the Great, is explicitly mentioned. He's used as a model in earlier Masonic manuals, so clearly he was the inspiration. It's the fall of Solomon, the Israelite, into heresy, and the commercialization of Tyre, and what they believe is the philosopher king, the inversion of the Platonic idea. Tyre is the archetypal commercial republic, based on plutocracy, materialism, human sacrifice to Moloch. And you see a vague outline of the concept of tolerance. And tolerance comes down to its arcane definition, where they combine Baal and Yahweh as the same person, which, by the way, also occurred in ancient Israel after Solomon's misrule. Just so happens that the 19th degree is also the degree where the infamous oath to Lucifer and Prometheus is made, as they're considered the true leaders of humanity, separating man from God and freeing him for his own designs, or that is, the designs of the elite. And as I've said 100 times before, Lucifer and Prometheus are seen either as the same person or the same idea. The second reference to Peter the Great is in the 22nd degree, the Knight of the Royal Axe, the Prince of Lebanon. That's the degree where Peter, Cromwell, Napoleon is analyzed in the work of the later 19th century Russian lodges. It's the creation of a police state. Once the new revolutionary order is established, something that Golitsyn actually accomplished for a time, when the older order has been destroyed, its defenders neutralized, the Masonic craft has to now defend the revolution through the creation of a new cadre of police to clamp down on dissent. All of a sudden, their previous calls to freedom of expression no longer are heard. So Mackey's work, and he takes from much earlier works in English, but you see this in the Russian manuals too, you know, about 100 years earlier. It's a full admission that at least some of the hidden meanings of these Masonic terms are openly demonic and certainly can't be connected with any of the three religions of the Holy Alliance. The Rosicrucians were huge in Russia, and thanks to Michael Hoffman, one of their key ideas is the revelation of the method. That's the slow but sure, this gradual revelation of their secrets to the world. And of course, this has now regained some credence among Christian writers, thanks to Mr. Hoffman. This is the sort of masonry that Golitsyn adopted. Needless to say, it put him at war with the church. But given his high office, he had access to everybody. And he could talk to people like Photius Spassky, St. Philaret. But he also surrounded himself with the likes of the Baroness Krudener, the English Methodists, Quakers, Jesuits, the Moravians, they used to be called Hernhuter, the prophetess Tatarnova, the so-called spirit bearers, visionaries, clairvoyants, everything that came out of the cacophony of the Reformation. His particular lodge was the Masonic Society Erasmus, very bohemian, of course, extremely liberal, meaning that he didn't change anything. He just found a way to justify it. I want to quote from the great Archimandrite Photius, who wrote in his text against Masonry. He says this, and this is from 1824. Actually, this comes from a letter that he sent to Alexander warning him about his friend. According to the influence of this society, especially known under the name of the Illuminati, on the whole world, from among the commissioners sent by the society for plans everywhere and in Russia, there is especially still alive in the family of Koshelev. In Russia, he is the head of all the evil trends in religion and the state under the guise of piety, as one of the illuminated ones and sworn enemy of the throne and altar. He caught Prince Golitsyn in his hand, seduced him under the guise of piety to do everything for a predetermined goal, and in order to act together to give birth to a reform, a constitution, and so to speak, to dig up the foundations of the church, to undermine secretly and imperceptibly the throne of autocracy, and to bring Russia to that, so that it not only could not upset, resist the establishment of some kind of world government, but so that it could even be lured into helping with this very movement. That was written in June of 1824. The fact that the Illuminati was mentioned this early is interesting. Now, he also mentions that the lodge had set aside the year 1836 at a time when both church and state will fall, and in its place will arise some variation of the French revolutionary state, controlled by the oligarchy. Golitsyn was fabulously wealthy. And as I mentioned, this was all sent to Alexander before it was too late. Now, Golitsyn's views were immature and chaotic, but it certainly doesn't imply a lack of an agenda. Of course, he wouldn't deal with anything inconvenient. He had no intellectual or spiritual foundation. The only thing he had was his erotomania. Masons like D.P. Runic, who knew him very well, said he's surrounding himself with every, and he lists every religion you could think of. And of course, he had become not only the chief prosecutor, but the minister of spiritual affairs and public education, which is an office that he created. The point of which, of course, is to destroy the church in reconciling them all into one super church without any doctrine. Golitsyn, in all of these positions, implemented what he called a program of spiritual education, explicitly developed by representatives of Rosicrucian Freemasonry, which, again, the unification of faith, culture, and politics, with the goal of building a single Christian republic, a kingdom of freedom and justice. It was his passions that made him a revolutionary, but of course he would never use blatant rhetoric like that. He always couched it in some version of very crude Christian language. So Golitsyn, being a personal friend of the emperor for a long time, secularized many of the offices. I mean, he, like Byron, he thought nothing less than the removal, sought nothing less than removal of the Orthodox Church, and ultimately, the crown, within Russian life, seeking a republic run by his fellow plutocrats. Of course, one of his first, when he was appointed chief of the synod, one of the first things he tried to do was strengthen the power of the chief prosecutor, that is, himself, doing everything he could to influence all the cases that came before it. But it's not just Golitsyn. Ever since Peter the Great created this, when he abolished the Patriarchate, most of the leaders of the synod, the secular leaders of the synod, have been either totally secular, Masonic, or even outright atheists. Now, in 1812, Golitsyn persuaded Tsar Alexander to read the New Testament, which I find very interesting, and of course never the Old. But that New Testament was under Masonic auspices. Yes, of course he had read the New Testament before, but not this way. Now, Alexander took an oath to defend the Orthodox Church. And one of the things that Golitsyn created around this time was the Russian Bible Society, which was run by Protestants, Jews, and Freemasons. Their influence was very strong, especially English-speaking Protestants. And one of the main means of achieving their goal was a so-called translation of the books of the New Testament into various national languages, and specifically conversational Russian. But the nations that he's talking about already had their Bible that's accessible. So they're not talking about translation, they're talking about rewriting. Keep in mind, you know, this is the second time that so-called Bible correction became a part of a revolutionary agenda. Unfortunately, in 1813, Tsar Alexander became a member of this society. Him being a member gave the impression that this is something everyone had to join. It became an organization of the political elite. And the course, although unbeknownst to Alexander, was the elimination of the Orthodox Church in Russia. The crown rests on this church. The Bible Society became a sort of ideological litmus test, even a school for incoming personnel in state offices. Another factor was Mikhail Spolansky, the founder of the Polar Star Masonic Lodge. This was a new revolutionary ideology, but it wasn't to last. Now, it was starting in 1816, the Bible Society began translating the New Testament into literary Russian, with all of the commentaries from the Masons added a bit later. Golitsyn was so confident that he was making derogatory statements, not just about the church, but Church Slavonic. In the Bible Society's report for 1815, he wrote that even the emperor, quote, removes the seal of an obscure dialect that has hitherto blocked the gospel of Jesus from many Russians, and opened this book from the very infants of the people, from whom not his purpose, but only the darkness of time has closed it. clearly he just picked up on the old rhetoric of the Reformation, claiming that no one understood the language. Now, Church Slavonic was understood by all literate Russians. The old believers had taken over the entire Russian countryside, exclusively using Slavonic, and he likely knew that. No one trusted this translation. It wasn't a translation. It was a commentary. It was a rewriting. But ultimately, the goal was to build the same Protestant chaos, to create religious objectivism, and of course, the destruction of national unity by the creation of new sects and schisms. And that was its goal. Golitsyn, at the same time, was promoting translation and publication of all kinds of Masonic books, extremely anti-Orthodox ones, and that became basically required reading through the Bible Society. But given his position, he then began to ban the works of the true Orthodox, anyone who refuted the positions of the Masons, and took violent measures against them. He declared war on Orthodoxy as a Freemason and sexual deviant. In fact, the first edition of the Bible Society's translation of the New Testament was so bad that it was publicly burned by the Patriarch of Constantinople. So in this period of time, Golitsyn was guiding the very impressionable Alexander and being trained in the world of Catherine, a completely secular and Francophile world, bringing Russia to universal Christianity, the equivalent of all confessions. And of course, the point was to have an upheaval in the political arena. This was a Protestant utopia, and it became official ideology for a few years. The Bible Society was dominated by Western Europeans, Protestants specifically, Jacobins and Freemasons. You had a couple of synod bishops. You had a Catholic archbishop, Lutheran, Anglican pastors, and representatives of all the weird sects that I mentioned already. But what happens when you do this? What's the real problem here? Well, if you're trying to equalize these groups that blatantly contradict each other, often in fundamentals, and claim that you could reduce them to one body, then you inherently have removed the ability for Christianity to make any truth claims, and hence its destruction. Of course, it's going to generate contradictions. Doctrine ends up going out the window, and the church ends up, or any religion, ends up being just an emotional, subjective belief easily cast aside. Because if you're saying that blatant contradictions don't matter, and hence doctrine isn't all that important, you have nothing left but subjective, emotional beliefs that have no grounding in anything. Now, the Bible Society tried to do its own version of the Slavonic Bible in 1814. Again, this was, a fraud. The minute people thought, they're good guys, they already had the scriptures. They had the scriptures even in the time of, in the Renaissance, of under the Novgorod, Bishop Gennadius, St. Gennadius, who fought the Judaizers, a very similar group, just 250, 235 years before. It's only 2 years later that this brand new literary Russian became the language of this Bible. And everyone knew what really was going on here and what the purpose was. I mentioned Golitsyn as Minister of Spiritual Affairs and Public Education. He was placed in that. I mean, he created that office. So he eventually stepped down as a chief prosecutor of the Holy Synod. Now, this was a brand new ministry, divided the Department of Spiritual Affairs on the one hand and the Department of Public Education on the other. The Department of Spiritual Affairs was purely ecumenical. All religions are the same. They're all true. Hence, doctrine can't mean anything. Doesn't matter if they contradict or not. So this brand new office that he created combined theology and education. So there was just a means to impose all of this on Russia. The ideology implied in all this is that the contradictions among various religions were just a subjective concern and dismissed. To put it simply, if doctrine didn't matter, then Christianity can have no stable beliefs, because that's what a doctrine is. If that's the case, and the church could be replaced with some vague secular ethics, which is very common in the Masonic process as you go up the degrees. Of course, all the main positions in his new ministry were occupied by Freemasons and members of the society. The point was to create a cultural revolution based on a variation of the Rosicrucian ideology. And of course, shutting down all dissent, because revolutionary ideologies, by their very structure, can't tolerate opposition. Now, Golitsyn, what did he say? In creating this new super domestic ministry, he talks about, I'm going to quote him here, talks about overcoming the destructive spirit of the last century and its spread, the harmful idea of irreconcilable hostility that must exist between religion and science and among religions. Europe has paid for this pernicious dream with rivers of blood and tears. Now, it's odd, because he goes from saying religion and science to religion and religion. I can only assume he's talking about the previous religious wars, but that had nothing to do with science as such. Then he says, he calls on the Tsar to sanctify the sciences with the spirit of religion, at the same time, arm religion with all the aids of science, so that Christian piety would always be the foundation of true enlightenment. Again, this is an exoteric terminology. What he means by religion or science or enlightenment, not necessarily the definitions that the common population might use. He uses this verbiage until the method could be revealed. So when it came to education, science, and of course he ran the censorship, despite the fact that the 1804 censorship charter, which was fairly liberal, continued to operate, he ordered the establishment of certain departments of the knowledge of God and Christian teaching in all Russian universities, and attendance at these was mandatory. So you have Western academics who have no idea what all this means, have no idea what Masonry is, or Exoteria, or the Arcana, believe all this to be incredibly conservative and royalist, and of course oppressive, having no idea what this really means. And what it means in practice was that Golitsyn purged the student and teaching staff at the big universities in Kazan and St. Petersburg, removing all Orthodox, you know, strictly Orthodox teachers, and censorship was sharply strengthened. And it hurt his reputation. Because not only now is he deriving this from his incurable sexual deviance, but his now immense wealth. The Orthodox Church, thanks to Peter and his allies and Freemasonry in the middle of the 18th century, was reduced to a shadow of its former self. He regularly mocked and belittled Orthodoxy. Now, of course, this also, because you still had a fairly healthy society despite everything, a true Orthodox opposition developed, demanding Golitsyn's resignation, the liquidation of this ministry, the prohibition of the Bible Society, Masonic lodges, and all the rest. Golitsyn was a very powerful man. You had not only secular traditionalists and royalists, people like Mikhail Magnitsky, Alexei Arkayev, far more famous, Shishkov, and then later, as I mentioned, the Archimandrite and St. Innocent of Penza himself, among many others. Needless to say, of course, any attempt to resist Golitsyn was harshly repressed. The opposition was, at least in the beginning, secretly headed by Alexei Arkayev, who knew what the Masons were. He knew what the prince was really doing. But by 1822, Masonic lodges were banned, a huge defeat. Archimandrite Foch Spassky, as I mentioned already, in 1824, sent these letters, 9 or 10 of them, warning him about what's going on. Foch, the Archimandrite, was a great man. He was a professor. He was at the cadet corps. He was preaching starting in 1820 against the Bible Society, claiming that this is going to cause nothing but chaos. His letters and his own charisma changed Tsar Alexander I, even saying that he was divinely inspired. And this is where the lodges were highly discouraged. But of course, none of that mattered if Golitsyn wasn't dismissed. Golitsyn eventually was forced to resign, and his ministry abolished. We'll add more detail here in a little bit. The Bible societies would eventually be abolished, but that had to wait until Tsar Nicholas I. Despite the fact that he was removed, Golitsyn still was one of the closest advisors to the emperor. And even under Tsar Nicholas I, 1839 to 1841, he chaired the general sessions of the State Council, and in 1842, dismissed again because of his erratic behavior. Golitsyn finally died in November of 1844. And Golitsyn is known in detail only because he was so powerful and so arrogant. On the one hand, he wanted to abolish monarchy, not just in Russia, but elsewhere, like all revolutionaries do. But at least for the time being, and he was aware of what Peter and the rest did, but in the short term, it was a political tool to force, his ministry couldn't have worked if he didn't have the imprimatur of the Tsar. Claiming that this is against subversive teachings, but again, after the disaster of the French Revolution, they had to start talking like this. Masonry is the godfather of all revolution. Now, their slogans were very typical liberal slogans: religious tolerance, equality, equalization of confessions, rejection of the state status of orthodoxy. They hated the fact that the church functioned as a check upon them. And this westernized elite and oligarchs absolutely loved. I mean, there were plenty of exceptions. But all this was to be imposed on unwilling Russians. And it wasn't just the men I've mentioned, but also the unbelievers. It wasn't for nothing that they said that Antichrist is ruling in Petrograd. But Golitsyn's actions proved what a lot of people already knew, that the left was a totalitarian sect. And once Golitsyn fell, the church had to purge these institutions of the same infiltrators who had no right to be there in the first place. St. Innocent Smirnov, who died in 1819, young man, was one of the key figures. He was well aware of what had happened in Russia since Peter, within the 18th century. He knew that an educated Russian society, orthodoxy was seen as a bumpkin's religion. Catholicism was seen as more sophisticated. And the same goes for Freemasonry. Another so-called Protestant mystics in the reign of Alexander talked about the inner church, the direct fusion with the divine spirit. These aren't exactly Protestant slogans, but it was a religious coloring for rationalism and liberalism, since this kind of individualism would do away with churches altogether. The key element that Golitsyn liked was these ostensible experiences, these personal mystical experiences that, of course, didn't require either a church or reason. It was a medium step between true Christianity and pure secularism. If the church is unimportant, dogma is no longer important. No doctrine can exist at all. And again, as I said before, indifferentism leads to doctrine being strictly an emotional and experiential thing. The whole concept, as St. Innocent himself mentions, the rejection of any mediating connections, considering them unnecessary or even evil. So everything from church organization, liturgy, icons, the same agenda as the Judaizers, late 16th century Novgorod, etc. But again, the verbiage that they use is usually meant to be a disguise. If doctrine doesn't matter in the church, and there's no grounding in any kind of truth claim anymore, then why would you believe any of it? There's no reason to. It's not grounded with any authority, so sects are always going to proliferate. The same thing for, in Protestant Europe. The individual, then, adrift in chaos, can easily then be herded into a revolutionary movement. But people like St. Innocent, the old right, many of the monastics, they were in the way. And talk about these so-called Protestant mystics. I'm talking about Jung Stilling, by the way, who claimed that Jesus Christ was incarnate in him, J.M. Guyon, Constantine Eckhart Tolle. But one of the leaders, too, in Russia was Alexander Labzin, who was a student of a man who's considered the founder of Russian Freemasonry, N.I. Novikov. Labzin founded his own Masonic lodge, the Dying Sphinx. He said, Labzin said about himself, that if it were not for faith in the grace of the Lord, I would be Satan. And he created the literary vehicle, the Masonic magazine in 1806, Zelensky Veshnik, with the permission, of course, of Prince Golitsyn. Labzin, with Golitsyn's support, published and translated many of the subversive teaching from Western Europe, and he became the main supplier of Masonic literature in Russia. Again, this is why the old right saw Petersburg as the seat of Antichrist. This stuff was promoted officially. Archimandrite Fosis Spassky says this, and he's talking really about the translation that Golitsyn was promoting. What good could come from such a childish translation with the participation of students of the Theological Academy, from people who have no divine grace in themselves? Having the Spirit of God in themselves, they will clearly hate this Russian translation and will curse its evil principle and all those who work in it. It's clearly contrary to God. These translations in various forms were coming out in various books of the New Testament. The point was to have the revolution taking over in a more systematic form than it did in the violence of Peter and Catherine. But anything like that has to start with the church because the crown rests on it. The modern Russian language was newly coined, very unsuited initially for translation, especially under these circumstances. A.S. Shishkov, one of the members of the opposition to all this, said the following. If church books, in order to lower their importance, are translated from the high language that has become sacred to us by no one knows who, and how into the common language that we speak among ourselves and in the theater, if with the dissemination of such translations, unless they're so needed that over time we won't understand the church service, or so that the liturgy can be served in the language which the comedies are written, in addition to that, in foreign languages, instead of our prayers and gospels, moral teachings, so-called spiritual philosophical, in the truth sense, the carbonari and revolutionary books are translated. If I say all this continues as before, that I am not fit to be the minister of education, for, in my way of thinking, education that is not based on faith and loyalty to the crown and the fatherland is darkness and harmful error. Alexander Shishkov was, of course, the minister of education once that office was reinstated. The point being is that the totally non-orthodox and hostile Bible Society claimed to be able to translate the books of the Bible. The result was a foregone conclusion. The fact that this translation was to be carried out on the initiative of either Freemasons or those close to Freemasons was extremely important. The first person who wanted to publish the Bible in the common Russian language, or the literary Russian language, was Novikov himself, the founder of Rosicrucian Freemasonry in Russia. Now, in terms of official translations, it took a while. The unofficial ones were floating around, and in fact were disseminated. The church wouldn't recognize the Bible Society's translations. Needless to say, the old right refused to consider it. Orthodox people began to be educated as to what revolution is, since under the crown, at least in this generation, they weren't subject to something like the French Revolution, although in the 18th century they had pretty much the same thing. The Bible Society was talking about the good of humanity in general. They even began talking about introducing a universal language as, and this is a quote from them, a universal human instrument for expressing the spirit that will unite all peoples into a single family. Another leader in the revolutionary movement was Baroness Krudener, obviously of German background. She was one of the central, very wealthy, one of the central figures of this movement in Russia. Talked about, quite explicitly, the imminent collapse of the entire false order of things. False, of course, being monarchy. In 1817, She said this: "Now a battle will inevitably take place, a terrible battle of unbelief against faith, false Christians against the true worshippers of Christ. The French Revolution was only a preface to this battle." Now, I don't know if it's because she was very wealthy, that she was a woman, that she could be so blatant about it. But her and many others' explicit connection of her movement to the French Revolution just settled everything. I also want to note the use of the word Christ. You notice she doesn't say Jesus. Christ in the Masonic literature doesn't mean him. Christ just means Messiah, you know, the anointed one. It does not refer to Jesus. Christ is a title, not a person. And she goes on to say this: "The mystics are not against the authorities, since the authorities and their behavior do not diverge from the will of God. But when the authorities begin persecution, this is the ancient war of darkness against light. Princes and officials are only slaves of the devil, because they are not guided by the Spirit of Christ. Woe to the states whose life is not in him. The sound of their fall will soon be heard." Now, there's a lot of doublespeak there. I don't know who she means by authorities. Clearly, she must mean the bureaucracy in some way. Under Alexander and Golitsyn, she seems to think that they're doing the will of, quote, God. It's only when the Orthodox resistance is able to take over, then they all become slaves to the devil in her mind. Again, the devil is not Lucifer or Prometheus. It's people like me and you. They knew, the true Orthodox knew what the Bible Society was. They knew who Prince Golitsyn was, how violent he was, how impulsive he was, what sort of a man he was, and what he promoted. Going back to the great Saint Innocent, whose given name was Illarion Smirnov, he became the rector at St. Petersburg Seminary from September 1813. He also became the head of the censorship committee for the Theological Academy. He was very well educated. He began teaching monastics, at least from 1805. He eventually was exiled to Penza in 1819. But he was also a teacher of rhetoric, teacher of philosophy, and also the inspector of the seminary. But it was, and he was a secular man when he did that, but he did take monastic vows shortly thereafter. The tonsure was done by Metropolitan Platon of Moscow. And a lot of this is known from Archimandrite Photius's biography of him, who knew St. Innocent very well. And he saw a man of great strength, always studying the law. He wore a hair shirt, prays incessantly day and night, denounced the decay of morals in Alexander's Russia, condemning what the foreigners were bringing in. Photius was one of the closest people to St. Innocent. And it was the Archimandrite that brought St. Innocent to oppose what was happening. In a conversation in his biography of St. Innocent, he essentially quoting him, and he's reporting on a conversation they had, and St. Innocent said this: "I was with some princes of a foreign confession. I talked to them a lot about faith, and they all proposed to me about uniting all faiths into one, and especially told me the possibility of first uniting the Lutheran confession with the Eastern Orthodox. They also told me about the image of a new faith by which it is possible to unite all of them into one confession. Seeing and hearing the cunning of these princes, the work of Satan is in their hearts. I refuse to converse with them. It is marvelous that already in these days there are servants and spirits in whom the mystery of lawlessness is at work, which is now considered holiness under the guise of a purified religion and a newly born church. In conversations, in books, in their societies, they speak and hope for some new faith, new teaching, new mysteries, a new church, a new spiritual kingdom, a new holiness, a new hope, and some, a new love, about which, of course, Christian revelation is completely silent." The Archimandrite wrote this in 1821. In 1812, St. Innocent was transferred to St. Petersburg again in terms of spiritual education. He was in the Department of Church History, and he taught at numerous seminaries as a historian as well as a philosopher. He dedicated himself. Now, clearly, he's going to clash with Golitsyn here. He became an assistant of Archbishop Mikhail Desnitsky, who later became the Metropolitan of St. Petersburg, and became friend with St. Philaret. But he also, given his positions in Petersburg, he entered high society. He had no choice in the matter. He was constantly rubbing shoulders with them. But as I mentioned, in 1813, he was appointed the head of the censorship committee. And he was very strict. Even Orthodox works, if they had many errors, he would send them back for revision. Clearly, this is no different than how academia works. The major presses in the U.S. are tightly controlled and censored. But since he knew that a war had been declared in the Orthodox Church, this was essential. They're already talking about rivers of blood, praising the French Revolution. In 1817, he wrote The Outline of Church History from Biblical Times to the 18th Century. And that was essentially an abridged version of his courses and became standard, a historical textbook in the seminary. And it was inspired by The Outline of Church Biblical History by St. Philaret, Metropolitan of Moscow. Obviously, he came into a confrontational contact with the debates, the base Golitsyn. He had, of course, censored all Orthodox works. He talked about free thought, which is a code phrase. It just refers to adopting the revolutionary and bloody ideology. But here's what St. Innocent said at this point. The hellish mirror of the hellish inner man and other free thinkers, babble talkers, false teachers, false prophets, vain, proud, completely carnal and depraved people, good for nothing. Is it really true that the darkness of the scholarship of the impious Jacob Behm, the satanic depths in the book The Mystery of the Cross, and the ravings of Stilling's Victory Tale, and the fermentation and whirl of the mind of the Frenchwoman, de la Maguillon, and other hostile darkness of the world and the flesh, now seems sweeter than the tearful springs of theology and love of God of St. Ephrem, John of Damascus, St. Cyril, Climacus, Maximus the Confessor, etc.? He mentions the carnal and depraved. Of course, he's referring to Golitsyn then. But these names, Cyril, Damascus, Climacus, these were totally foreign to Golitsyn. In 1815, St. Innocent rejected the publication of the Jungstilling book, The Victorious Tale, as he's already mentioned. This guy, Jungstilling, expected the second coming of Christ in 1836, despised Orthodoxy as well as Catholicism. He thought Orthodoxy was just pagan, identical to the Judaizing sect in Novgorod three centuries earlier. As if to prove the falsity of this teaching, he started calling himself Christ. But in his esteemed opinion, Orthodoxy was damaged and pagan. Only the Protestants, and the Moravians, founded in 1722, were the only repository of truth. Golitsyn demanded that it be published. Another book came out, The Cry of the Woman Clothed with the Sun. In 1816, that was Stepan Smirnov, no relation. It was a condemnation of Jungstilling. Now, we don't know much about Smirnov. He was a secretary of the Moscow Medical and Surgical Academy. He wasn't very well known. He talked about Freemasonry at great length. But it's hard to tell. I mean, it was mixed reception even in Orthodox circles. Smirnov sent it to Alexander I. One of the ways they tried to convince him that if the Jungstilling kind of mentality took over, there would be no more crown. And remember, this is just no literary debate. Many of these ideas had already taken over in Russia a century earlier, let alone just the French Revolution and the British Revolution before that. Smirnov, even back then, talked about the global Masonic movement bringing Antichrist into the world. The overthrow both of Orthodoxy and the crown. I mean, Masonry is conspiratorial by its very structure. But you had some otherwise good churchmen oppose it, including St. Philaret. St. Innocent, however, allowed it to be published anyway. St. Philaret thought that Smirnov was excessively zealous, beyond caution, and he had a problem with Innocent for allowing it. These were great men. Of course, many of them changed their opinion, but they tended not to see the emergency that was unfolding. St. Innocent in 1817 was extremely upset by this. He knew Lobzin and Zionsky Vesnik. He tried to convert him, and it went nowhere. St. Innocent then addressed a very sharp letter to Prince Golitsyn, and he says, among other things, "You have wounded the church, so you heal it." In other words, those that seek to destroy the church are in no position to help it. Golitsyn, very much like an angry American professor, filed a complaint against Innocent with Metropolitan Mikhail and insisted that the censor apologize to the chief prosecutor, which at the time was still Golitsyn. Innocent was forced to do it. But for someone like Golitsyn, that only showed weakness. It satisfied nobody. Forcing him to apologize was a very naive move, although there may have been fear as to what Golitsyn could do. But it didn't matter. Sensing blood in the water, the prince considered himself insulted, and his hatred of the church just intensified. He couldn't grasp how someone could dare oppose him. At this point, St. Innocent said, "I don't want this position anymore." But that resignation was rejected. Now, let me mention something here. I know I've gone way overboard. In his address to the Tsar on his name day, this is near the end of St. Innocent's life, this is part of what Innocent preached to him. "Anyone who violates the command of God here hears the definition of his fate. He who reads the message to the angels of the churches reads his future destiny. I am coming soon. We who gather in the name of Jesus hear and believe this. Behold, I am coming. The procession of the wrathful God is varied. Short-sighted wise men do not see it, where it's already happened. Stubborn hearts, attributing everything to the natural course of things, do not notice it, at the very time it's being fulfilled. The hardened hearts convince themselves of the impossibility of this event. On the contrary, those who fear the words of God, both openly and secretly, meet God coming with righteous wrath." His address on the name day of Alexander was filled with this kind of rhetoric. These words are chosen carefully because he's admonishing Alexander against people like Golitsyn, Masonry, the Bible Society. And all these other people had to hear it. The sermon, among others that were given to the emperor, loaded with references to the punishments that will befall bad kings and bad judges. He talks about oligarchy in his speech to the recently appointed judges in Petersburg. Essentially going on, and as St. Innocent's works are all online and in Russian, basically what he says is, I'm quoting here directly, "As long as our thoughts and desires are so nailed to earth that all our hopes do not extend beyond the earth and are based only on human power, so long will our judgment be governed by people and not by law and truth. Then our benefit or harm, the strength or impotence of those judged, will decide every case." He's warning what the revolution would do. So when he was able to address those with power, including the Tsar himself, he continued to hammer away at what this movement truly was. In 1818, Zionsky Vestnik was banned, and it never was resurrected. The Orthodox resistance grew in strength and power. The truth of the matter is, at the time, there was no neutral ground. Either the revolutionaries would censor everything, or the church had to defend itself and censor revolutionary doctrine. There was no middle ground. Someone was going to censor it. You can't condemn someone for doing what the American publication world does every single day. Some of the members of the Orthodox Party were friends with Golitsyn. They were constantly lecturing him. Golitsyn kind of gave in. St. Innocent was eventually exiled in disgrace because of all of this stuff. Again, because of books like Shishkov's Conversation of Lovers of the Russian Word and their attacks on Zionsky Vesnik. Just like I mentioned before, these books, Stafi Ivanovich Stanovich, who died in 1835, was at issue. Very similar kind of idea that St. Philaret refused to ban it. Many, even in the Orthodox Party, didn't like it. The same kind of thing. Permitting it to be published meant Innocent was in trouble. At this time, Golitsyn was still in positions of power. Golitsyn said in anger, "The church has no need when a private person takes it under his protection, especially from the point which the entire work was written. The defense of the external church against the internal fills the entire book, a division that is incomprehensible in Christianity. For the external without the internal church is a body without a spirit. In general, the concept of the church is presented in a distorted form in this book. For wherever the church is spoken of, it's everywhere evident that the clergy alone is taken for. In a word, this book is completely contrary to the principles that guide our Christian government and its spiritual and civil aspects." I don't think Golitsyn bothered to read it. I think he heard about it from others. This man was a vicious censor himself and had so much trouble when someone else did it. Again, you know, St. Philaret tried to get Innocent to soften his position. St. Innocent said in response, "I'm ready to endure any persecution for the truth." St. Innocent was not supported by the church hierarchy. And these books, Stanovich in particular, but many books like this, as I've already mentioned, as soon as St. Innocent went into exile, they burned. The inner Christianity is what Golitsyn seemed to believe was being condemned here. St. Innocent, and in his exile, actually, was consecrated bishop of Orenburg and Kazan. Then later on, he went to places like Penza. 1817, St. Innocent, having been tormented with all of this, it was only his private donors that allowed him to get everything he needed. The Countess Anna Orlova, who had money and provided him so he wouldn't, you know, starve or get sick, sent him a carriage, some money, doctor, footman, cook. And St. Innocent recommended, and she took his advice, to become a spiritual daughter of Archimandrite Phocius. The disease that he became sick with was unknown. His ascetic practice, you know, he chose the cold floor in front of his desk where he laid down, but he developed what we used to be called consumption. He was exiled to a distant diocese with a harsh climate. Certainly could lead to the death of a man who was already sick, which was, I think, the point. I also think this is part of why Alexander would resign his office and become Fyodor Kuzmich, seeking forgiveness for this and several other sins. He died on October 10th, 1819, but it wasn't until 2000 that he was canonized. But it was understood in a popular realm that he was a saint and a great man. And that is how Orthodoxy was saved in Russia. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will, as always, talk to you next week. Bye-bye.